Hi, this is Pastor Chris, and welcome to Strength for Today from Living Hope Baptist Church in Geneva, New York. Today is Tuesday, March 31st, 2020. We have been examining our life principles, and yesterday we considered this one, that we ought to treasure the Bible. Today, I would like to suggest another, and that principle is think carefully. Think carefully. One of the questions I've been asking myself as I tease out these life principles is, what principles do I want my children to hear and incorporate into their lives? That question and today's principle, to think carefully, immediately drew me in my memory to a Formica-topped kitchen table in the middle of the 1970s. My father is seated on one side and I am on the other, and there's a chess set between us. And I hear his encouragement to me to think carefully, to look over all the pieces and consider the various threats and opportunities before I make my move. And then I see myself make a move, only to find that by doing so, I have walked into a trap and now will lose my peace. That's what I mean, my father says. You need to think ahead. You need to think carefully. Chess, like most other disciplines, is a microcosm of life. What we do or fail to do has results, and failure to think carefully can cause us to lose the game. But what is thinking? To suggest that we should engage in careful thinking before we have even identified what exactly we mean by thinking would be folly indeed. In the sense that I am using the term here, the dictionary defines thinking as employing one's mind rationally and objectively in evaluating or dealing with a given situation. But I have to be honest, I don't find that definition extremely helpful. It leaves us to wrestle with the meanings of terms like mind, rationality, and objectivity. Now, I don't know if I will be able to bring much more light here, but I'm going to try. When I think of thinking, I begin with the stuff with which thinking is concerned, and that is the data. I mean by data the reportage of our senses concerning what is out there and what is in here. The out there includes all the items, ideas, and events that have, or seem to have, an existence of their own outside of me. This would include things like trees and cars and buildings and other people, God, and so on. The in here are the feelings I experience, the flow of my emotions, the experience of my thudding heart or my breathlessness or the like. Now, without delving more deeply into epistemology, I will suggest that all these constitute data my senses bring to me. But there is more, of course. There are the propositional truth claims that my ears encounter when I listen to the ideas of others, the truth claims my eyes process as they read, and all these claims are data that flow daily into that being I call myself. But none of this, I think, constitutes thinking. The data is bombarding the person, but as yet the person, that is I, has done nothing with it. So now we come to the actual work of thinking. At this point, it would seem helpful to distinguish between various uses of the word I. There is the I that receives that data from my senses, recording or experiencing it indiscriminately as it flows in. There is the broader I, referring to both the organs that receive the data and to the recording of experiencing it. And then there seems to be a third broader I, which sorts, prioritizes, evaluates, and responds to the data. So in a sense, within myself, I observe recorders, messengers, and analysts. And then at the top of this strange organizational chart sits one who makes decisions. This is the I that considers the data that has been recorded and reported, compares and contrasts the analyses that are provided, and then decides if and when and how to respond. This is no easy task assigned to the ruling I. He must choose from a mind-numbing, and yes, that was a pun, mind-numbing range of options. He can choose to ignore the data, labeling it unimportant or irrelevant. He can table the data, considering it momentarily incomplete or unnecessary. Or he can act on the data. And those are just a few of the available options. If we consider how the ruling I might act on data, we again find ourselves confronted with a plethora of options. If the data merely asserts the existence of a person or item, he can choose to receive or reject the data. If he receives it, it accepts or concludes that this person or item truly exists in that realm we've entitled out there. The same is true of any experience. He, that is the ruling I, will examine the data from, if you will, his internal sensors and conclude or reject the reality of that experience. It is, of course, impossible to envision one rejecting the internal reality of one's own experience, but I think that points only at a general congruity and not to a flaw in our reasoning. But this has been easy so far. The acceptance or rejection by the ruling I of events or persons as experienced. What is the case, however, when we turn to truth claims? Let me provide an example. So let's imagine I have a conversation with someone one day at a coffee shop, and he says to me, "I am your friend. You can trust me." My ears report the words to my mind. My eyes tell me that the body language of the other person is consistent with the statements. My analysts in my brain tell me that this person is using the English language in the way I normally do, with the similar meanings I assign to each word in keeping with our societal and cultural surroundings. Further analysis is done, and I identify that at least there are three truth claims. First, this person claims to be my friend. Second, this person says I can trust him. And third, this person claims there is some sort of relationship between the first two truth claims. Well, my ruling eye now has much to consider concerning these truth claims. First, he must evaluate the likelihood that any or all of these are true. The first task is complicated by the evident separation between his, that is my, mind and the mind of the other person. He, my ruling eye, cannot take a trip across the mental galaxies and somehow visit the other person's administrative center. My ruling eye can only come to a conclusion about the likelihood of a statement beyond a reasonable doubt. And yes, I use the word reasonable advisedly. It means my ruling eye must weigh the presenting information, conclude that any objections to the veracity of the claim, the truth claim, are unsubstantial or unwarranted. And if he, that is my ruling eye, does so, he will figuratively stamp that truth claim as accepted. But there are varying levels of confidence the ruling eye might have. His senses may have reported, my senses may have reported and recorded that at times this person has claimed to be a friend and yet has done things considered unfriendly. In such cases, the eye might stamp those with a decision deferred stamp, suggesting that more data will need to be gathered before a final decision can be made. And of course, at times, the truth claim may be utterly rejected and the claim itself stamped accordingly as rejected and then sent to filing. Well, second, once he has evaluated the veracity of the truth claims, he, that is, my ruling eye, my administrative center, must consider the implications of each truth claim individually and then corporately. So going back to my illustration, my eye determines whether I will believe and accept the truth claim that this other person is indeed my friend. If I do, then I can consider a range of responses or instructions to be sent throughout my being. This might include uncrossing my arms, smiling, lowering my mental defenses, and etc. Well, the man also said I can trust him. Again, if I accept this, I will embrace that he cares about my well-being, that he wants me to have beneficial experiences and to be safe from harm. He claims a correlation between these two claims. And if I accept that truth claim, then I accept his claim that maybe buying his brand of life insurance is in my best interest. And then, accordingly, if I've come to all those decisions, my ruling eye delivers the order, and the rest of my body obeys, and my hand signs the papers. So what is the thinking in all of this? I expect it is all of that. It is the recording and the reportage of the data, the analysis of that data, the deciphering and varying and often contradictory truth claims, the acceptance, rejection, or decision not to decide on those truth claims, the compilation of accepted or possible truth claims into other truth claims, the evaluation of those claims, and of course, the interpretation and application of those truth claims. And the latter cannot be taken lightly. I may accept all the truth claims in my illustration and still refuse to buy this guy's insurance. Perhaps I already have another life insurance policy. Yeah, there might be other data. As is clear now, at least to me, thinking is a lot of work. And it leads me now to remember this quote from Martin Heidegger. What is truly thought-provoking in this thought-provoking age is that we're not yet thinking. Well, yeah, maybe we're not because it's a stinking lot of work to do. And if I'm honest, I have to admit, I'm just a bit lazy. Or maybe I'm overwhelmed by the seemingly endless things about which I could think. If I belabor every decision, analyze every option, I may find myself standing all day long before my cupboard, unable to decide whether to wear the gray or the blue trousers. Let's go back to my chess game with my father. I'm sitting there. I'm an 11-year-old kid with, I think, undiagnosed ADHD, and I've been waiting for what seems an eternity as my father's going to make a move. Finally, he does, and then he looks up at me and says, "Your turn. Think carefully." I look down at the board. My father's move has opened all kinds of new dangers and opportunities. My senses tell me that I must look in every direction, examine every possibility. I see his rook, his pawn structure, his queen lurking over there in the corner. And I think about moving my pawn, but then I see his knight, and my internal analyst tell me the knight is only two moves from forking my king and my queen. And as I sit there, the noise in my internal headquarters crescendos. My ruling eye begins to sweat. And instead of considering the possible moves, it begins to ponder the implications of losing the game. Finally, the ruling eye within me is overwhelmed and decides to relinquish the choice to fate or to luck or whatever, and he gives the first directive at hand and moves the pawn. So my father takes the pawn and says, "See, you walked into a trap. You need to think more carefully." Ouch. I suspect that these kind of inner struggles go on in most people's inner world every day, and it is exhausting. No wonder people come home from work, plop down in front of the TV, lie on the sofa, and vegetate. They are tired. The work of thinking has exhausted them. And in their depleted state, they collapse in the living room and chew on that bubble gum of the mind we call TV, in which all decision-making has been done for them. And why not? We are tired. This leads me to consider what I mean by the word carefully in our principle, think carefully. Here I think it means at least two things. First, as I've discussed, it means to take the time to collect and to consider all the truth claims and all the other data, to deliberate upon their probability and to project the likely applications, and then to select the most noble, the purest, most true, and to accordingly choose to act. But second, I think the word carefully refers to making wise decisions concerning what is most worthy of your consideration. We cannot devote our concentrations to everything always. We must choose. And so, if we are indeed to think carefully, we must establish some sort of ranking system which we can use to determine what is worthy of our time and our energies. Then, when our senses bombard us with data, we will be able to pre-sort it and delete what ends up on the table of the ruling eye. But where will we find such a filter? Well, the answer, of course, is in the Bible. The foundational teaching here is found in a principle that we've already examined, that we should love the Lord with all we've got. This principle is taken from the command which Jesus said was the foremost command in the Mosaic law, that we should love the Lord our God with all our heart, with all our soul, and with all our mind. This indicates that our minds are, first and foremost, to be dedicated to thinking about Him and what matters most to Him. This reality is reflected throughout the Bible. Consider the statement given in Psalm 1 concerning the righteous man. It says his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in His law, that is in God's law, this man meditates day and night. See, that is the description of one who is thinking carefully. He is engaged perpetually in thinking and pondering, and he is engaged in careful thought, in that he is perpetually pondering God's law. We see the same idea expressed again in the New Testament. In Philippians chapter 4, verse 8, Paul writes, "Finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there is any virtue, and if there is anything praiseworthy, meditate," or think, ponder, "these things." You see, Paul is encouraging us to use those standards as a filter for our thinking. He is encouraging Christians to use careful thinking that disregards the negative and focuses on the positive, the godly. And then consider the words of Jesus. Speaking to a poor, oppressed people, he said, "Do not worry about your life. Don't think about it. Don't ponder it in that sense. What you will eat or what you will drink, nor about your body, what you will put on." You see, he is encouraging his followers to filter out their worries, to think not about menial things. And he says, God knows that you need these things. And then he says this, that rather than worrying, choosing to ponder and meditate on their needs, their physical needs, that they are instead to choose to think and act this way, seeking first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. It seems to me that this principle, to think carefully, is for us Christians a call to prioritize God in our thought lives, to ponder his mighty work for us and for the world in Jesus Christ, and then to proclaim his virtues to all creation. Then to my non-Christian friends, I would suggest that this principle, think carefully, is best employed in the examination of the greatest truth claim in history, that Jesus Christ is risen from the dead. This, I believe, above all other truth claims, is worthy of your consideration. Finally, let me say this to all believers who, like myself, are living today in the chaotic and strange times occasioned by the COVID-19 outbreak. I encourage you to focus your mental energies today, not on the gloom and doom accompanying the pandemic, but rather on all the excellencies of the Godhead manifested in Jesus Christ. Ponder him, glorify him in your thought life. And let me finish with one other thought worth thinking carefully about. The best is yet to come. God bless.